This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And when do you know that the signal is real? What is the unmistakable sign that things are about to change? Like finding the melody deep inside a dense symphonic score. What is noise? Historical noise. What is the clear signal identifying the past? How much noise is there in economic data? When does the number reveal something we can act on? How much meaning is there in the noises around you? All this hour, the noises and signals of news, of history. What would it literally have sounded like in the 14th century, for instance? We're going to go there. What are the sounds in your own life? We're even going to give you the opportunity to switch a sound off that you would prefer to do without. Present company accepted, of course. We begin with the most serious discussion, though, of signals versus noise right in the headlines. In a moment, we will hear the fear and alarm of a grieving sister who is hoping against hope for the release of her brother, Kenneth Bay, detained as a convicted spy in North Korea for nearly a year. A family's pain, looking for a clear sign of progress or intention from the indecipherable North Korean government. Bay's mother has just seen him in prison. We'll get an update on his condition. But first, Karen Lee, Executive Director of the National Committee on North Korea, joins me. Karen Lee, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a puzzle to me why the Kenneth Bay case doesn't have a higher visibility in the U.S. government or in U.S. North Korean policy. Does that puzzle you?
Well, the previous cases that had a higher profile, I would say, also had family members who were better connected to the media and were able to raise the profile of their family member to greater visibility.
Although, is that what's needed here? Doesn't the U.S. have an interest in getting an American citizen released from prison in North Korea, regardless of the media savvy of the family?
Absolutely. And I do believe that the State Department is working very hard on this, as is the Swedish embassy, which represents U.S. interests in Pyongyang. I think, as most people know, this is the American detainee held for longest in the DPRK since the Korean War. So from the outset, the DPRK indicated that they wanted to use Kenneth Bay to teach a lesson to Americans to stop breaking North Korean laws when they are in the country. It's a tragedy for Kenneth Bay's family, of course, and Kenneth Bay himself.
And of course, we have no confirmation that he broke any laws explicitly or had any ill intent against North Korea. He was a tour guide over there. We're going to hear from his sister in just a little while. How much have other events distracted the nuclear issue, the detention of this boat in Panama that contained weapons? I noticed the big story in Pyongyang today is half the country is out in the streets celebrating the opening of a water park.
Well, it is true that Kenneth Bay's detainment has taken place at a time when U.S.-North Korean relations are at a low, and also when pressure on the DPRK resulting from their third nuclear test is at an all-time high. So, for example, the ship that was detained in Cuba, that kind of inspection of North Korean cargo just wasn't taking place at the same rate several years ago. And certainly, I think you see a lot of people, organizations, countries that are very concerned about any affiliation with North Korea today. I don't know if you read this story that China has been holding up an oil shipment to North Korea that was stated in the Japanese press to be from Iran. And Iran said, no, no, it's not ours.
Well, there's a tremendous pressure, but what the pressure points are and how they're received in Pyongyang is the issue. And the lack of a real dialogue between the U.S. and North Korea also an issue. Karen Lee, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Karen Lee is Executive Director of the National Committee on North Korea. So it's not exactly clear where the family of Kenneth Bay should place their hope these days. Serving a 15-year sentence for hard labor for allegedly attempting to overthrow the North Korean government, Kenneth Bay's mother, Myung-hee Bay, was granted a visit with her son earlier this month, a response to her shock at seeing him in a North Korean video.
My heart was broken into pieces when his prison interview was released on July 3rd because his appearance was very shocking. He looked so different and he lost so much weight. I could not believe That prisoner was my son.
Myung-hee Bae has since returned from Pyongyang. We spoke with her daughter and Kenneth's sister, Terry Chung. The visit has been the first tangible sign of anything since Kenneth Bae's detention.
You know, it's been incredible and really emotional. It's been almost a year now. November 3rd will be exactly a year since he was first arrested and detained in North Korea. And, you know, during that time, there has been very little contact. And, you know, he's been especially so isolated in prison by himself and also from the rest of the world. And so I think to have that time together, I think has been just incredible. And really, hopefully, he's soaking up all that love, not just from my mom, but from the rest of us as well.
Mothers can be worried in the best of times. How worried was she to see Kenneth, and how is she feeling right now?
I think, you know, her heart has been aching throughout the last year. But, you know, going into the trip, she was really nervous because, you know, we had heard that he's been in the hospital for 2 months. And before that, he was, you know, serving in the labor camp for 3 months, laboring 8 hours a day, 6 days a week. And I know, I think his body had just started to give out. And so we were incredibly worried. We weren't sure what she would find in the hospital. So, you know, it's been just a lot of heartache. And then I think leaving was also hard because she had to then leave him behind. You know, I think she came back with a renewed sense of commitment that, you know, he really needs to come home now. It has been a year, and I think seeing him there, I think really kind of solidified for her sense of, wow, he really is a prisoner. And, you know, it was hard for her to see him in the hospital gown. He's confined to a, you know, a very small room, and as he had been for the past 12 months. So all of that, I think, hit home for her. And, you know, I think she came back with, you know, just the renewed sense of we need to bring him home now. He's the longest American that's been detained there. And he's the only one, as far as we know, that was actually sent to the labor camp. So, you know, I think just all of that was, you know, very concrete for her now that she had seen him in North Korea.
You know, Americans have this sense of North Korea as a kind of a bad international joke. You've got Dennis Rodman going over there. You've got, you know, late night comedy shows making sport of the way in which North Korea can be a parody of itself. How do you respond to all that? And particularly the idea that, you know, Dennis Rodman goes over there and, you know, there's a giant press corps. Your mother goes over there and it's very different.
You know, it's hard for me because I'm not an international relations expert. All I want is I want my brother to come home. You know, it's been 12 months, and it's really unfortunate for us as a family to experience the dynamics and the conflict between the two countries somewhat firsthand because he is caught between, unfortunately, in the ongoing tension between the two nations. And yes, I would like there to be, you know, an engagement between the two countries and to be a dialogue. But first and foremost, I want the dialogue to be about Kenneth Bae, about this American who's been left to languish in North Korea for a long time. You know, from our perspective, 1 day longer is too long at this point. Our worst fear is that any day now he can be sent back to the labor camp, and then that would be a death sentence for sure. That's why for us, there's even more urgency than ever to negotiate his release, to try to see if there's interest in another envoy and so on and so forth.
Who's your best contact in the Obama administration? Do you have one?
I don't have. Our family has, you know, we're just an ordinary American family. We don't have powerful connections in politics or media. I don't have a direct line to, you know, former presidents or vice presidents. So we just do the best we can. We write letters. Our family has written several letters to President Obama, Secretary Kerry, to various congressmen. And, you know, we try to contact our members of Congress in Washington, hoping they would be our advocates for us. And, you know, when we write letters to whoever will listen, frankly, and say, hey, do you know about this American in North Korea? Can you help us? Can you speak for us? Because our voice isn't loud enough. And can you be our voice to the people who have the power to negotiate his release?
Well, I don't, you know, I'm afraid I don't know what's ordinary about your American family, Terry Chung, but if there was a message that you wanted to deliver directly to them that would push it beyond "we're working on it" to something more urgent, what would that be?
I would say, yes, we are ordinary in the sense that we are hardworking family. My brother was a hardworking father of three, and he was working in North Korea to provide for his family as a tour operator. And now he's been there for 12 months, and it's been an incredible hardship, not emotionally, but in many other ways you can imagine when one's father is away and imprisoned and unable to work. So I would say, you know, don't forget about this American. He's just one man, but he is an American citizen, and he is a father to three, and his health has deteriorated, and he has chronic conditions that need to be treated once he comes home, and so he needs to come home now to be reunited with his family that really, really miss him and are really suffering as a result of this really lengthy detainment, and I really ask that they do make it a priority to bring Kenneth home after a year.
Terry Chung, thanks so much.
All right, thank you for having me.
Best of luck to you and your family.
Thank you.
Terry Chung is the sister of Kenneth Bae, the American citizen who's been detained since last November in North Korea. And as a radio public service, we are going to do what we promised this hour. Hear that din? We're speaking to someone later this hour who finds meaning in noise, but we asked you about the noise that would give your life meaning if you could eliminate it. Shirley Becker from Minnesota, can you hear that? People chewing food with their mouth open. Okay, Shirley, gone.
This is Ian Smith from Salt Lake City, Utah. The noise that bothers me most is car alarms.
Ian, out of there. Mihail McMorgan from Colorado would love to get rid of the sound of politicians. Oh, don't we all, Mihail? Be gone, drone of politicians. I love this.
Hi, my name is Stephanie, calling from Chicago. The noise I would love to get rid of, construction jackhammers.
Stephanie, your wish is my command. Ah, sweet, serene silence. In radio, that's usually what we're trying to get rid of, ironically, but we'll talk more about noise and the meaning of noise later this hour with Professor David Hendy and you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to tell us that noise you'd love to never hear again.
The Takeaway is sponsored by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 12 Years a Slave, the true story of a man who overcame more than a decade of injustice to reclaim his freedom. In theaters October 18th.
The government's back up and running after the shutdown, and for nearly 3 weeks, of course, unemployment didn't go anywhere, just the unemployment numbers delayed with everything else shut down. But they're out today. The September jobless numbers show unemployment down to 7.2%, while the U.S. economy added a relatively tepid 148,000 new jobs. Economists will be mulling these over now, including our next guest. But what we wanted to know is, how dependent are economists and the economy itself on all of these federally provided statistics? And how did the government get into this numbers business? Heidi Moore, finance and economics editor for The Guardian U.S., says we're basically flying blind without the feds.
The federal government is really the primary provider of our vision of what the economy looks like. They tell us about everything from unemployment numbers to, you know, certain kinds of manufacturing indexes. We get surveys through the government. The government is really our main source for knowing how America is doing economically. And although we do have private sources, a lot of universities, for instance, the data isn't comparable at all. A lot of that is minor data.
And the sort of provenance of federal data, it really comes from a period of time when it was difficult to know what was going on in the U.S. economy. All you got was sort of noise from various sort of commercial commentators, bankers making risks here and there. And so the idea was that the federal government would be an independent arbiter of economic data. Where did that come from?
You know, it actually started way back in the census of 1880. That's when we first started measuring unemployment. And then it really developed. And not surprisingly, it was during the Great Depression that the government started to really want to know how many people were out of work. So it started first under Hoover and then really took off under Roosevelt with the Works Progress Administration in the first census. It grew out of the census, and the first unemployment report had 20% unemployment and 10% of people who wanted to be employed but couldn't find work.
So that's a 30% full employment, discouraged workers, the whole thing, right?
Roughly. And wow. I know, isn't that remarkable? Yeah. And then officially the real unemployment report as we know it now started in 1939, 1940. And what's also interesting is that initially the unemployment numbers were an employment program for statisticians who weren't finding work elsewhere.
Oh, that's interesting. So they created the program to put statisticians to work.
Essentially.
Love that. Now what we've seen is that so many federal programs and so many triggers of employment contracts, retirement programs, these sorts of things relate very directly to numbers on inflation, not so much unemployment, but certainly inflation numbers direct payouts on all sorts of levels, private and public.
Yeah, absolutely. We use inflation numbers to judge Social Security, for instance, and, you know, entitlement payments. We judge all of that by how much it costs people to buy goods and services, and the government measures that as well.
And how much of a moving target is all of this? I mean, you've had the sort of basket of goods that determines what the consumer price index is all about modified a number of times. And I still think people feel as though prices are going up no matter what the number, which is really hovering around zero, seems to be in any given moment.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we don't often look at the root of these statistics, and a lot of them really are moving targets, as you put it. You know, for instance, with the Consumer Price Index, which measures inflation, we don't really look at the price of food and gas. And if you look at your budget—
I never buy food and gas.
Right.
I never do that, ever.
Yeah. Why would anyone do that in America? So the government doesn't really look at that when they're calculating inflation. And by the government, actually, in this specific case, I really do mean the Federal Reserve when they're looking at how the economy is doing.
And the inflation number is very, very important because it helps to set monetary policy. And taking food and gas out, while it seems insane to consumers, actually makes sense because there are seasonal fluctuations in food and gas that you wouldn't want to base policy on.
Exactly. They're really volatile numbers. I mean, gas could be up one month, down the next month, and you don't really know why. It's hard to get a sense of the full trend, and so you don't want to base national policy on things that move up and down so much. Of course, that means that there's a gap between what we feel in our budgets and our wallets and what the government thinks is going on in terms of inflation.
Now, the original mission of the government doing the economic surveying was that it was independent, but I think we've seen in these times a political sense of at least, if not the actuality, the incentive to play with the numbers a little bit to make politics work out the way campaigns want, for instance. How much trouble do economists have trusting the independence of federal economic numbers from politics?
It's interesting. Economists are used to trusting the federal economic numbers. The assumption is that the Bureau of Labor Statistics is not going to skew the numbers according to politics. But if you look at where we get these numbers, it's not random, but it's an uneasy sampling of the United States. So, for instance, the unemployment numbers. We get those by surveying 60,000 households. 110,000 people. That's how we know what's happening in a nation of 330 million. And they do swap out the households every, you know, few months, every 4 months or so. But we're still basing our view of how the entire economy is doing across the country on 110,000 people, which really fit in a few Manhattan apartment buildings if you think about it.
What economic numbers are noise to you and what ones really matter to you?
Well, the unemployment numbers are really crucial. Inflation, you do want to watch on some level just because it's something that economists really look at. But in terms of noise, I would say numbers like consumer sentiment or any kind of sentiment, really, because those are just how people feel. It's very, you know, vague and watery and squishy, and you can't base policy on it. And people tend to be terrible predictors of what happens next.
And with the government shutdown and these numbers absent for so long, have you had for the last 3 weeks an empty feeling inside walking around?
It's been a little bleak. I've really had to get in touch with my inner child and, you know, feel a little bit better about what the world is really about, try to understand that. But honestly, what we know about the unemployment numbers is bloggers and pundits love when these come out. There's a game almost. It's called NFP guesses for non-farm payrolls. And they try to guess what the numbers are going to be. And of course, it's, you know, kind of a game. But it's also a demonstration of how totally random these numbers are, even to the people who are watching them carefully. It could be anything. It's a guess.
Having had to seek her inner metric for the last 3 weeks, now relieved that the numbers are back from the federal government. Heidi Moore, finance and economics editor for The Guardian U.S. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Big Science. It's no stunt.
This is Jeopardy, the IBM Challenge. Here are today's contestants. From Los Angeles, California, Brad Rutter. An IBM computer system able to rapidly understand and analyze natural language, Watson. And from Seattle, Washington, Ken Jennings.
A supercomputer named Watson defeating Jeopardy stars Ken Jennings and Brad Rutter in 2011 was not simply a deft bit of corporate branding. And Watson didn't win because it needed no sleep or bathroom breaks. Watson won because of the ways in which big data and massive capacity computers can create the kind of judgment engines we associate with experts in the world, geologists, meteorologists, or Watson's perhaps most interesting new gig, making life and death decisions along with doctors. Kara Miller, host of WGBH's Innovation Hub, says this new Dr. Watson role has already shown promising contributions to traditional medicine.
One of the fascinating things about Watson is that at the time that it was on Jeopardy, it was really a coming together of all these different technologies that had reached maturity. So the ability to understand natural language, which is actually really hard. If you think about the kinds of things we say, like that was a bittersweet experience or catch you later or I'm feeling blue. If you think about those things literally, they make no sense, right? But Watson was able to understand them. So it's that, it's this incredible amount of data processing, and all those things came together to be able to interact with humans in a way that computers really never could before.
And the skills and the science required to take big data, huge databases, make judgments, goes directly to medical applications for, I guess we'd call him Dr. Watson now?
Exactly. Well, here's what we've seen recently. Machines are getting better at learning. Here is Steve Gold from IBM talking about what actually happened when Watson started working with the doctors working on cancer at Memorial Sloan Kettering.
We literally have been training Watson to assist oncologists in identifying the proper course of treatment for cancer patients. And so we began with lung cancer, and we've progressed to breast cancer. But when we got to colon cancer, we realized that a lot of the training that actually had taken place on the previous forms of cancer were germane to Watson's understanding as to how to interpret, decipher, and ultimately provide insights to the oncologist as to what the optimal course of treatment might be.
Watson is learning.
Exactly. I mean, one of the fascinating parts of machine learning is that you're teaching computers to recognize patterns. And so one of the things they found is that by the time Watson got to their third kind of cancer, colon cancer, he had learned a lot about cancer from the first two experiences he had with looking at different kinds of cancer.
As you know, I love your enthusiasm about all this, but what do medical students think of this sort of thing, interacting with a machine like this that learns so quickly?
You know, one of the things that's happening with medical students is that they are going to get – this has happened in a Cleveland Clinic, for example – is you're looking at medical students who are going to probably have iPads loaded with Watson's brain. And they're essentially going to say to Watson, here's the information I've got and here's the information, you know, that I need. Or you should ask the person, did your mother have this? Did your father have this? You know, where were you born? So there's some piece of information missing here that could get me from 70% certainty to 95% certainty.
So next job for Watson, get rid of all the lawmakers and politicians and take over Washington. What do you think?
I it could happen. I mean, Watson is actually, he's multiplying, he's in the cloud. And Watson is actually going to work in Wall Street, in call centers, trying to deal with your call and actually get you to the right person, which would be a miracle if it could actually happen. But this application of Watson, big data, and actually being able to process natural language would be kind of amazing if it could all come together. And so far, that's what we're seeing.
Of course, my director, Jay Cowett, is worried that we're going to get into the Skynet Terminator zone here. Kara, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Kara Miller, host of WGBH's Innovation Hub. History is pretty visual. You can see a photo from a century ago. You can visit a room in a museum from the 1300s, right? Even stand before the paintings in an ancient cave where humans stood 30,000 years ago. But what would it all sound like?
The art, turns out, it seems to be in the really echoey part of the caves. So we can imagine, we're guessing, people going into these caves to chant, to roar, to provoke echoes. And to think of these echoes building up into a cacophony of sound. And echoes that would strike the people in these caves as if they're new sounds, as if they're sounds coming from behind the wall. So it was a kind of communication with the spirit world. And in these caves we find fragments of bone flute. We find rock pillars which look as if they've been repeatedly hit, filled with the sound of rituals that involved chanting and calling to summon up the supernatural.
All of that is correct, except you wouldn't hear the energetic sound of David Hendy's voice there, conjuring up soundscapes from human history. Hear what he does with the 14th century.
I suppose one of the defining sounds of the Middle Ages would have been the bells. Bells ringing out from monasteries and parish churches, not just ringing out the time of day, but calling people to prayer. The sound of the bells was something that drove away evil spirits. But of course, it depends where you were. I'm talking about bells as if the same bells were ringing everywhere. But if you go to somewhere like Istanbul, as it's now called, Constantinople, as it was, you would have had this extraordinary soundscape with calling to prayer for the Islamic mosques, some church bells. And also, at certain times in its history, instead of bells, which were banned, it would have been the wooden cimantron. Planks of wood that would have been beaten very loudly and rhythmically in place of bells.
David Hendy would know all this because as professor of media and communications at the University of Sussex, he is in love with noise. Not in the way you might think, as mere meaningless din, but noise as a form of media, conveying the meaning of a time, as when the world entered the industrial age.
In the factories of Britain, say, there are vivid descriptions in Birmingham and Manchester of the extraordinary noises of hammering and metal upon metal and engines, hisses, roaring. Sounds that are described as earthquakes. Elevated railway rattling very close by. Dazzling mosaic of voices and accents in the street, Irish, German, Polish, Italian, Jewish. The cobbled streets would have been very noisy, with iron-rimmed wheels of horses and carts, much noisier than the first motorised traffic. And, of course, a lot of home working. It was in these tenements that thousands and thousands of sewing machines would have been clattering away, making cheap clothing.
We're turned on by noise this hour, and we'll hear what sounds David Hendy would switch off if he could. Tell us what sound you would turn off if you could, from this time or any other.
You would think that working from home as a writer would be really great and be really quiet in our neighborhood, but it is so noisy. There are all these carpenters hammering away, and it can be difficult to be home and concentrate on writing and not be annoyed by all the noises.
All right, Deborah, through the power of radio and because we are just good folks all the way around, we're going to hit the fader here. Now, get those brilliant thoughts down on paper. Lisa LaRocque McMahon from Rhode Island. You know, I'm with you. Let's lose the finger drumming, she told us on Facebook. And we'll do an upgrade with real drummer Neil Peart from Rush. Sarah from Dallas would turn off those adorable, irresistible
alpaca that live next to us. Now you would think, oh, alpacas are cute. No, they scream.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to share the noise that you want, most of all, to turn off. And with all this talk of noise this hour, we thought we would spend some time thinking about how noise, how sound itself, defines time and culture. The seeming randomness of economic numbers, the digital pings and pops all around us, voices, music, traffic, all mean something about how we live our lives. We've been hearing from you all hour about the things you would turn off in the din of your own lives. David Hendy, though, is really the master at all this. Professor of Media and Communication at the University of Sussex and author of Noise, A Human History of Sound and Listening. Noise, he says, is like all media. It's everywhere and is trying to tell us something if we know how to listen.
Sound is something which, yes, we take for granted, but which has some sort of power over us emotionally. It's been described as touching at a distance, and this is both dangerous and scary because, of course, if power can change our mood and emotions, then it's potentially a means of controlling us or us controlling other people. But it's also a kind of rather wonderful thing because here is this thing that actually we can all do. We can all make sounds. And in that sense, it's a very democratic and exciting and volatile thing as well.
What is the transition from orderly sound like speech to beautiful sound like music to noise, which doesn't often have positive connotations?
For me, as a cultural historian, what's really interesting is that different people over history have had a very different set of ideas about what's noisy and what isn't noisy. So to talk about the European colonists who went to America in the 16th century, for them, the sounds, the languages, the speech, the music, the singing of Native American peoples was noise. It was hideous, it was meaningless, it was demonic, and so on. And I suppose the nearest I could get to defining noise would be noise is a sound that someone somewhere doesn't want to be heard. And I think what's interesting about that is it doesn't necessarily refer to the actual aesthetics, whether it's musical or not, but it refers to the idea of the social disagreement. In other words, one person's music is potentially another person's noise. And really it's about control. It's whether it's a sound that you can turn off or not that I think turns something into noise.
The descriptions that you have of wartime noise that are as evocative as any other element of the battlefield. How did you, first of all, get those descriptions? And can you put yourself in some of the places that you describe?
Well, war, as they say, is hell, and it also sounds like hell by other people's accounts. If you go to, say, some of the remains of the trenches on the Western Front from the First World War, they are incredibly quiet, peaceful places. It's very difficult to imagine yourself there surrounded by noise. But if you read memoirs and diaries and descriptions of those who fought in the First World War in the trenches, it is very striking how much noise and sound was a defining part of the experience. And of course, that's partly because if you're in the trenches, in these smoky battlefields, and you couldn't really put your head above the parapet, a lot of the war, you had to work out how it was going through sound rather than through vision. So yes, it was very, very noisy with all the gunfire, artillery, unending artillery bombardments. But you learned as a soldier to decipher, to decode these sounds, to use sound to work out the position of enemy guns. And of course, there are a whole range of other sounds that you can imagine, the squelching mud. And occasionally, of course, there are quiet moments in war and people would have had a very strong emotional attachment to home. They would perhaps play gramophone records and play music to remind them of home and so on. So there's a rich soundscape. And this was very, very powerful. And those soldiers who, after the war, suffered from shell shock very often experienced it in the form of noises in their head. So in other words, it wasn't just that they were traumatized by noise at the battle. They were traumatized by it for many years afterwards.
One of the narratives here is how we go from the gramophone era, where people would take Mozart out into the deserts of Africa and experience a new joy at the music, to the 21st century, where people are most irritated by the noise in the headphones of the person sitting next to them, or the boombox and iPod player that's happening in a city street. Have we passed some threshold beyond which we can really make sense of the noise?
It's certainly clear that at some point in usually the middle of the 20th century somewhere, and it's usually associated with the mass media, with radio and television and commercial music, that sounds became pervasive and somehow always on, and it's that always on quality which is irritating and perhaps has changed. Noise, the noise that other people make, has always been an issue. If you go back thousands of years, in ancient Rome, people are complaining about the noise of people, the noise of city traffic, of nighttime deliveries, and so on. So complaints about noise are pretty constant throughout history, wherever you have people crowded together. And it seems to me that perhaps the issue isn't so much the sounds we make as the fact that our social life is becoming much more complex, much more crammed together. We are having to share the same spaces in a way that we haven't in the past. And that means that we kind of, we find it harder to rub along together. And sound and noise becomes a kind of bone of contention, because that's how shortage of space and struggles over resources sometimes manifest themselves.
If you could, as an all-powerful professor of media and communications, turn one thing off in the noise of your own life, what would it be, David Handy?
I suppose for me, it's street traffic. I live on a fairly busy street in central Oxford, and once a year, we close the street and we screen films and the children come out to play, and it's wonderful. And I think if I could turn off the sound of street traffic, and if I could actually bring human life back into the streets of my city, that would be great.
David Handy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
David Handy is a professor of media and communication at the University of Sussex, author of Noise, A Human History of Sound and Listening.
Within the sound of silence, in restless dreams I walk alone.
No noise, but some history to end this hour. Yesterday, African-American scholar and activist and just plain great talker Henry Louis Gates came on the show, and we were just rambling all over the place about this new film, 12 Years a Slave and Django Unchained, and whether film director Quentin Tarantino was actually black, and how the race conversation in America, according to Gates anyway, is getting really interesting right now. Part of Gates' enthusiasm comes from the broadcast on PBS of his six-part documentary series, The African-Americans, Many Rivers to Cross. The six-part series airs tonight. We continue our conversation with the lively director of the Hutchins Center for African and African-American Research at Harvard. Henry Louis Gates says the encounter between Africans and America is a much older story than most Americans generally realize.
Everyone starts the story of the African-American saga in 1619, when 20 Angolans arrived at Port Comfort, Virginia, and then were sold into slavery in Jamestown. But it turns out that the first person of African descent whom we can identify by name actually arrived in Florida in 1513. He was a black conquistador. He was free. His name was Juan Garrido. And he arrived with Ponce de Leon looking for the Fountain of Youth just like all those other white conquistadors were doing. So we go exactly 500 years, half a millennium, from 1513 to the re-election and second inauguration of Barack Obama in 2013.
I mean, really, the story you bring here is all about how the world was a more mixed place racially before contact and the American experience. And then it was really the slave experience that separated the races, and now we're coming back together again. There's not some sort of in-stone separation of the races idea. This was created and then uncreated, and that process is still going on.
No, you're absolutely right. By the time those first 20 Africans arrived in Jamestown in 1619, there were already 500,000 Africans who had been shipped to different parts of the New World and to Europe. And there were always black people in Europe, always, that the West and Africa always had contact. And we know that, by, I mean by always, back from the time of the ancient Egyptians and classical Greece and Rome. And we know that because there were beautiful visual images created of people of sub-Saharan African descent. So that the Atlantic Ocean, the Red Sea, the Indian Ocean, and the Sahara Desert were highways. They were not barriers. They were highways, and they connected African civilizations to European and Middle Eastern civilizations from time immemorial. And you're absolutely right. Once the economic necessity to develop the New World emerged, a comparable simultaneous ideology, a propaganda effort emerged, a huge propaganda effort, which reduced Africans from their equal status as fellow human beings with Europeans to the category of a beast, a subhuman, an entity having more in common with apes than with human beings. And we, you know this as well as I, and it continues to play itself out in our society today. But it wasn't always there. Mm-hmm. It emerged from the economic necessity of shipping 12.5 million human beings between 1501 and 1866 across the Atlantic Ocean to serve as free labor for the economic prosperity of New World settlements. And to justify this terrible thing, which everyone knew deep down was wrong, they demonized and made subhuman African people.
Let's talk a little bit about how the contemporary story of African-American empowerment relates to some of the stories that you bring forward in this series.
Well, that's a great question. I entered Yale in September 1969, and I was one of 96 black men and women. By contrast, the class of 66 at Yale had six black men to graduate. What was there, a genetic blip in the race? And all of a sudden, there were 90 smart black people. We were the affirmative action generation. Well, cut to all these years later, and what's been the effect of affirmative action? The black upper middle class has quadrupled. But on the other hand, John, the percentage of black children living at or beneath the poverty line is almost exactly what it was when Dr. King was killed. So what's that mean? It means we have two classes within the African-American community. And no one anticipated that during the civil rights movement.
So this is quite a mission here. This is very ambitious. And I'm wondering if you have a clear sense of who your audience is for this history.
I'm making it for my daughter's generation.
Huh.
This is a series for all Americans who weren't old enough to watch Roots. And, you know, John, we've heard a lot lately, particularly after the Trayvon Martin murder, about the necessity for a conversation about race. Every time there's a tragedy in America that is race-related, there are calls for a conversation about race. And then what happens? 2 weeks later, there's another racial incident. How do we have a genuine conversation about race? Well, we have to have it in the same way and at the same place that America has conversations about how to be a citizen. And where do they take place? In our schools. Think about the things you learned in first grade. You learn, my country tis of thee, I pledge allegiance to the flag, America the beautiful, George Washington chopped down a cherry tree and never told a lie, you know, all those kind of things. Well, your teacher didn't say, hey, I'm going to teach you how to be a citizen today. They just show you, demonstrate implicitly how to be a citizen. That's what we have to do with the content about the African-American role in American history. We have to incorporate it into the curriculum. And what this series does is it allows any teacher to use a six-hour DVD and the companion book, which I wrote with the historian Donald Iacovone, and incorporate African-American content easily and accurately into the way American history is taught. So that, you know, we all know that we need to teach our children about George Washington, but we also need to teach them about his slave, Harry Washington, who actually ran away from George during the Revolution, joined the British, ended up in Canada in a free black settlement in Nova Scotia, and then ended his life in Sierra Leone, where the British moved a lot of the black patriots who had fought with them, and initially had ended up in Canada. It's this. We need to teach the story of the Emancipation Proclamation, but also the history of the contraband slaves whose existence was enabled by the Union Army victories over the Confederacy and the Emancipation Proclamation. We need to teach the story of JFK and LBJ making civil rights legislation, but also the story of the people who risked their lives to make those court rulings and legislation real, people such as Ella Baker and John Lewis and Charlene Hunter Galt and Ruby Bridges. In popular culture, we need to tell the story of American Bandstand for our generation, but also the story of Soul Train and how Soul Train made black culture the lingua franca of American culture. That's what we try to do in this series.
Henry Louis Gates, Jr., director of the Hutchins Center for African and African-American Research at Harvard. His six-part documentary series, The African Americans, Many Rivers to Cross, airs tonight on PBS stations. And tomorrow on the program, what price would you put on the impact of slavery in world history? 14 Caribbean countries will take their case for reparations from European nations for the transatlantic slave trade, taking the case to the International Criminal Court. What are their chances? Tune in tomorrow. What do you love on the program or not so much? You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening, noise and all. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.